Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is...
Corey No Tweet Knockreiner.
Corey No Tweet Knockreiner, even with his fictitious followers. On today's episode, we'll cover two news stories, the first being a really evasive, malicious browser extension with some research by Avast, and the second are threat actors targeting folks like Corey and I, frighteningly enough. With that, let's go ahead and hobble on in. So let's start this week with a update on some, I guess it's kind of old research from Avast. They noted about it a couple months ago, but Avast recently published some research into a set of malicious Chrome extensions that I wanted to talk about because it includes some really interesting techniques for evading detection and analysis. Malicious.
Leave it to pirates to find interesting things. Avast, you mateys!
Yar! Here there
Sorry,
be monsters.
Just joking, Avast.
So malicious.
Good research.
Yes, malicious Chrome extensions. They're not anything new. I feel like we talk about it every few months about a new wave of extensions getting kicked off the Google Play Store. But they seem to be this boogeyman that just won't go away, largely because attackers are adopting some of these new evasion techniques that we're about to talk about here. The majority of these extensions that Avast talks about in the research were all really similar. They're basically some form of video downloader for popular social media platforms. Like there was an Instagram video downloader, a Facebook video downloader, a TikTok video downloader. Apps that kind of circumvent terms of use for... social media sites that people still want to do, and they're not technically illegal, so up they go.
Popular, by the way. Luckily, I'm not affected by this, but I've had a YouTube downloader before for offline viewing, so it's not an uncommon thing for people want to download as an extension.
Yeah, and these apps are actually popular because they work quite well. Avast noted that some of these apps had hundreds of thousands or millions of downloads because they worked. They did what they were advertised to do. But somewhere along the line, the app developers or the extension developers added in some malicious code into their updates. Now, Chrome extensions are really just these bundles of web code. So HTML to format how it looks, CSS to make it pretty, and then JavaScript basically tie it all together and carry out different actions. And they're built with this manifest file that kind of defines what permissions they're allowed to use within Chromium. And I was digging through like Google's documentation, and some of the API access that you can get through extensions is honestly like kind of amazing. Like the amount of control you have over through an extension in a web browser. Like they've got APIs for overriding your computer's power usage. So like if you're in battery saver mode, you can control that from your web browser. Obviously, they've got all the web browsing stuff. So handling web requests and cookies and local storage in the browser. But they basically open up all of these APIs to extensions in the Google Play Store and ones that you load. With the caveat that the user is notified that whenever they install one of these of, hey, these are the permissions that it's requesting. Pretty similar to like an Android app where when you first start it up or as you use it, it'll pop up and say, hey, it's requesting permissions to use your camera. But in this case, it's through the web browser. And these extensions all requested several pretty powerful permissions where if you're actually paying attention to what they're asking to do, it's not stuff that you would expect for something simply to download videos off of a social media website. Like one of the permissions they request is the management permission, which allows the extension to control other extensions in the browser. It's got a request in there for the web request permission, which actually like that makes sense for a downloader. The web request lets you interact with web traffic, which is probably how they download videos from these sites. But that permission is paired with one that enables it to interact with those web requests across all URLs. So every single page that you visit in your web browser, this extension can interact with. Whereas if this were a quote-unquote legitimate video downloader, you might see it limited just in scope to Instagram.com and Facebook.com and whatever their CDNs are.
It should be very implicit to our listeners or explicit based on what you just said, but to make it more explicit, you know, this is your practical tip. With these bad extensions showing up on the legitimate store, this is your only chance to kind of detect whether something's good or bad. We'll talk a little bit more later about other things Google might do here, but management, why should any extension be asking to manage other extensions? So really don't just next through things when you're installing an extension. Pay attention every time it says, here are the permissions you're giving, and do a little thought work into, does this thing really need it? Or now that I know what this thing is saying it needs, do I really need to have it so bad that I'm willing to give up this control?
Yeah.
Because, you know, we'll talk more about practical tips and what Google could do here to help in the future. But just as a practical tip, you got to pay attention every time apps, especially extensions, ask for these permissions.
So right off the bat, it's got a bunch of fishy, really powerful permissions that it requests. On top of that, though, so extensions and really any app that uses the Chromium engine also has to abide by a content security policy, which basically defines what would the word be, like elevated JavaScript functions it's allowed to use and who's allowed to call it, what portions of the app are allowed to use it. This one is allowed to use the eval function, which is JavaScript's most powerful function, basically allows you to load up other JavaScript and run it as the context of whatever the extension is. Interestingly enough, so Avast noted that in the manifest, it says that it's got the content security policy that allows the eval function. But in the extension source code, it does not have the eval function anywhere in it at all. That doesn't mean it doesn't use it, though, and we'll get to that in just a second. So through these permissions, the extension has a few, it has its normal obvious features like downloading videos from social media platforms. But the source code that comes bundled with this has a couple of malicious features as well. So first up, it sets a listener for all web requests, and it saves all web response headers to local storage. So local storage is the persistent key value storage in your browser. It's kind of like session storage, except that gets nuked anytime you close the tab. Local storage will persist. Usually if you go to a website and you hit that remember me button, it'll save a authentication token in your local storage. So the next time you pop back up, it can refresh your session and you're ready to go. In this case, though, it's saving all of the response headers to local storage. So that's like what's an example of a header? My brain's frying right now. Basically any HTTP header. So like sizing, caching, as we'll get to in a second, and really anything at all. Then it's got another malicious JavaScript that'll look through local storage specifically for saved cache control headers. So cache control is normally how a server tells a browser how long to cache something for. So when you get a web page back, it'll say cache for a day, cache for a few hours. And your web browser, the next time you request that, will just pull it out of cache right up until that cache expires. But as it turns out, this extension was making calls to a command and control server, and the commands were coming back in this cache control header. It actually encoded it and quote unquote encrypted it within the header, which that first script would save into local storage, and the second one would then yank out of local storage, decode, and run. And so it's within these commands that came back in the encoded headers that is how the JavaScript managed to execute additional malicious actions. So this is an example of one of those headers that came back with a command saying use the eval function, which was saved in a variable. So it called the variable name that was then populated with eval. That's how they got to use it, to then download a second stage from this URL and then run it through eval. So you can see how they kind of piece it all together, where eval doesn't exist by default in the source code. And instead, it kind of builds a piecemeal from these commands it receives back from the command and control server. That was the first major evasion method that it had, which I thought was interesting. Basically, instead of sending commands through the HTTP response, a peasant malware author would, these guys went full hardcore mode and then hit it in a cache control header instead, which was kind of interesting. And I think unique to this flavor of malware. That's how it got its name, cache flow, from Avast. Outside that, though, so there were quite a few other evasion techniques used by the extensions that I thought were interesting. So first off, the command and control server would only send back that command through the cache control header, if a variable in the request was set that indicated the extension had been installed for over 3 days. So basically, for the first 3 days of you installing this extension, it did nothing other than its normal behavior. But 3 days down the line, when it beaconed back to the command and control server, then it would get its commands back. That's one method of evading analysis, or at least evading suspicion. Because, you know, if you installed an extension and all of a sudden all of your browsing went haywire, you would pretty obviously know what caused that. Next up, the extension actually checked for quite a few different areas to see if it was installed on someone that might be able to detect a computer. Like, it checked to see if developer tools was running, checks every second, and also anytime the window is resized. And if it detects that someone opened developer tools, it just deactivates itself. Checked for a hard-coded list of other extensions that are related to development and debugging. Each of them actually had a score, which was kind of interesting. And so if the scores totaled some certain threshold, it would deactivate itself. Kind of like how like an anti-malware engine would score different behaviors, and if it went over a certain threshold, it would kill
for,
it.
For the developer tools, by the way, this is a random aside, but it's something you see a lot nowadays in, say, phishing, where maybe there's a link with some HTML for the first phishing page. Maybe it's trying to fake O365. So there's some O365 looking message that says click here in the middle to do a login. I've noticed just in some of those HTML pages that if you either inspect element or show source, the link you will get for the click here isn't actually the real link. And I presume it's because of using some of the detect developer, detect inspecting element. Whereas if you actually follow the link normally, it goes somewhere else. So I don't know if that's related, but it's very interesting that they're trying to detect development tools, because smart people definitely do like to occasionally look at the source of any website or web application they're going to see what's going on.
Yeah, there was a fish sometime last year that I remember looking into where it showed different contents on the web page from when I visited it from like the WatchGuard corporate network versus a VPN from somewhere else. So they even identified either WatchGuard or like our IP range, and they were showing different stuff, which kind of made it a little more difficult to analyze.
It's definitely interesting to see that they're noticing people using the actual built-in developer tools of browsers.
Yep. Additional evasion techniques. So it had a hard-coded list of a registry or a regex where it would look for its own command and control domains and then watch the user's Google searches. And if the user started Google searching for one of the malware's command and control domains, it would deactivate itself. That was kind of interesting. So it kept an eye out for if the whoever the victim was trying to figure out what the heck was going on, it would kill itself so they couldn't see it. And then it also looked for users to see if they accessed private IP addresses or domains ending in .local, .dev, or .localhost. And if it did, then it would deactivate itself as well. So a whole bunch of just different anti-analysis techniques and ways of hiding from not necessarily super users, but users that poke around in the browser and might notice the suspicious activity. Now, that's all the evasion techniques. Now, how about the actual malicious actions that it tried to do? So once it gained a foothold and downloaded its malicious second stage and third stage and started running them within the extension, first off, it would try and steal your personal information out of your Google account by issuing requests straight to Google, which normally an extension or a second tab would be blocked from doing that by cross-site request protections. But in this case, because it had that all URLs permission, it was able to create requests on the user's behalf without them knowing and pull out their private information from their Google account. It also injected clickjacking script into all browser tabs, where for each link on the website, when a user went to click it, it would send a request back to the command and control server first, see if it was a link that they wanted to intercept. And if it did, it would rewrite that link on the fly and force the user to go to a different site instead. So Avast actually found one example where if you clicked on facebook.com, it fired you off to an attacker's website that was designed to look like facebook.com. And then it also injected forged results into Google searches. So if you searched for, they had an example of like a refrigerator from Home Depot, it inserted fake results at the top that like they actually included images in them to make them try and look a little more realistic, but the images were so poorly formatted, they kind of stood out. But either way, This was, I think they had about a half dozen or so or a dozen extensions, all using this similar behavior. Most of them were these social media downloader tools. And along with their legitimate use, though, they were able to do clickjacking, steal private info with cross-site requests, and then also insert these malicious searches into Google searches. That's quite a bit for these extensions to be able to do, all the while kind of hiding under the radar. And it kind of points out an issue with, in my opinion, like the Chrome extension store and like their abilities. Like, these are really powerful and they can do a whole lot of stuff. What do you think? Like, are they too powerful, Corey?
Sure feels that way. I mean, Google definitely knows that the management fee, you know, that the management permission to manage all extensions and the cookies permission are pretty big deals. So it feels like they should be able to do more to either not allow or really vet any extensions that are asking for those permissions, or B, I think one of the things you mentioned that when we chatted about this is being able to give users more details about, you know, people have probably seen these permission requests from Android devices or from Chrome itself, and maybe the normal user doesn't really get it. So maybe better descriptions of what permissions you're giving away are the least thing they should do for all these extensions in the official store. But maybe vet whether or not any extension besides Chrome extensions need that management one in particular.
Like, I get it. One of the things with Google is they're really hands-off. They rely on a lot of automation when it comes to approving apps for the Android marketplace or approving extensions for the Google marketplace. But maybe with some of these permissions, it should set a flag where if it's going to request management permissions, it has to go through a human review from Google. Like, obviously, that costs them money, but it's the trade-off for better security for your users.
I agree. I think we all like that Google's this open garden platform. You know, unlike Apple, they want to let any hobbyist develop something, which is actually, you know, mostly good. Any hobbyist does apparently include malware authors, but, you know, it's neat for just a 16-year-old that wants to play with neat extensions in Google that it's not hard for him or her to get something up there. So I think we all like the open garden environment, but they do need to do something more to vet. There are benefits to paying a little more attention.
Yeah, because like I mentioned earlier, this is not the first time that Google's had to nuke a bunch of extensions off of their marketplace. And it won't be the last time, because they're getting better at hiding their tracks. Like in this case, even though it had all these permissions, the code that was included with the extension, like, it didn't look super suspicious off the bat outside the permissions. It didn't have any eval functions in it. Didn't look super suspicious. It was actually able to do what it advertised. It's just hidden under the surface. It could become a lot more powerful and suddenly basically control your entire browsing.
I think that's the other thing. And this has happened more on the mobile stores before, both Apple and Google, by the way. But often that kind of 3 days later update, you know, extensions. And while we're talking about apps, mobile apps do need the ability to update sometimes. They are software like everything else. But it's not the first time we've seen threat actors post an app or an extension that is clean, and it's not until but it has some sort of HTML update mechanism that's sold to the people vetting it that this is to update the application, but really that update is the weaponizing Trojan of the application. So I wonder if there's more they can do to any extension that has some external mechanism to get additional updates of any sort. They have to be able to vet that update mechanism too.
Yeah.
And the update itself.
A lot of it revolves around using that JavaScript eval function, which lets you run other JavaScript in there that you get from some external file. And like, I'd honestly argue at some point it would make sense to just block that entirely. And like, they already have a really powerful API within Chrome that you can request through these other permissions, which, as we said, like, maybe they need more advertising on the power of those permissions, but still, I fail to see what you would have to have the eval function for that you probably couldn't accomplish with another API function.
And meanwhile, that eval function is one that, whether we're talking about extensions, malicious websites, malicious Google, anyone that's done threat research on JavaScript is well aware of eval is something to look at every time you see it.
I mean, in order to use it,
you're probably right.
In the content security policy, it's literally called unsafe-eval. because not only is it used like intentionally by these malicious ones, but it is a security risk if you use it otherwise in your code, because it can enable code execution in the browser if it exists in the first place. That's why it's called unsafe eval.
I'm with you. Block it.
Exactly. I'd like to see them maybe move towards blocking that. I'm sure there are plenty of extensions out there that rely on it heavily for some reason or another, but like Google's APIs are strong. There's got to be some way.
Who cares though, right? I mean, right. If it's that powerful, should they be relying on it? Is it the right thing? I would, maybe we're the security white tower people, but I'm like, who cares? You shouldn't be relying on it. It's literally, as you mentioned, unsafe.
I mean, in a somewhat related story, there was this other extension that just got banned today off of the Google Store, the Great Suspender. I'm not sure if you've heard of it, Corey, but it's an extension that had 2 million downloads, and it was used basically to suspend and put to sleep tabs after they've been open for a while so they don't continue to hog resources. See, I would expect you to have this considering you're Mr. 1,000 open tabs at any given time. But
if my MacBook didn't have 32 gigs, I would probably need it.
Yeah. But it was a really popular extension, 2 million downloads. It was based off of an open source project that back in January, the original author gave over to a unknown third party, basically. Like, understandably, he was tired of maintaining it, wanted to hand off the reins to someone else. What was just kicked off of the App Store today, because it turns out that the people that took it over were doing really fishy stuff to the point where Google labeled it as malware. They were using eval in there to load what they claimed were like user analytics scripts, so tracking user behavior, which is fishy enough on its own, but it finally set off enough red flags where it's just gone entirely.
I don't know, it's the same, but I should probably evaluate OneTab. I do use something called OneTab, which I don't know if suspend is the right word, but it literally closes all your tabs while saving links to them. Huh. To free up the memory. So maybe I should go back and make sure OneTab is not being like the Great Suspender new owners.
Exactly. Anyways, let's move on to our next story. This one is actually relevant to us specifically, you, me, and the rest of our team. So Google's threat analysis group, which we've talked about a few times with some of their monthly articles they publish, talking about different threat actors and their actions. They just published an article during our off week about a week and a half ago that identified targeted attacks against security researchers by government-backed entities based in North Korea. So the attacks started with the threat actors creating their own Twitter accounts and blogs with write-ups of vulnerability research and exploit research. They even used stolen guest posts to give themselves credibility. Google noted that several of these actually had videos that were faked to make it look like they had a successful proof of concept for some exploit. Like, they had one for a really recent Windows Defender vulnerability from just this year, but the video itself was faked. But either way, they set up these accounts and blogs to kind of give themselves credibility as researchers. Some of the Twitter accounts had amassed a couple hundred or 1,000 followers. And then once they've got this credibility, they started reaching out to actual security researchers, asking if they wanted to collaborate on vulnerability research. And for those that accepted, these threat actors shared a Visual Studio project with them that they were, quote unquote, trying to research, that actually included another malicious DLL, so a library, that Visual Studio executed through the Visual Studio build events. So if the researcher, the victim in this case, accepted this library and went to go build it, it would load up this malicious library, and then...
Wait a second, Mark. You're freaking me out. I just was working on this botnet project in Visual Basic with some dude named... I forget his name now. It was some weird Twitter handle. That might not have been such a good idea.
Let's take a tangent real quick on some of the names they use. Billy Brown was one of them. let's see, what was so Billy they Brown. Were basically, so they're threat actors out of
Rob
North Korea.
Steele.
All the names they use were either Chinese names or like these like Billy Brown, like the first thing someone foreign might think of for an American name. I don't know, it kind of stood out like a sore thumb to me. But
John Smith.
Yeah. they were somewhat successful though. Like, they managed to compromise several researchers. Google also noted that,
by the way, I think I saw a tweet from one of the researchers that got, you know, where he, in a Twitter, a multiple post tweet, he kind of outed the person and There's also someone named, I think it was Alana, another security researcher we both might follow on Twitter, that kind of forwarded someone that admitted this and is kind of trying to get the community to help dox the perpetrator.
Yeah. Also, though, actually a little more frighteningly, so Google noted that some of the victims were tricked into going to one of these research blogs. And then sometime after visiting that blog, their computer started beaconing back to a command and control server with a in-memory backdoor. And Google says that every single victim ran a fully patched Windows 10 system with a fully patched Chrome browser install. And they have no idea how they managed to get these backdoors installed on the computers. They actually had a plea for the last like paragraph of this blog post saying, if you know any of these potential zero-day vulnerabilities in the Chrome browser, let us know. We'll pay you handsomely. Because they have no idea how these backdoors got installed just by the victim researchers visiting these blogs. Pretty crazy stuff, honestly. This feels like James Bond level, like hack-backing, where this nation-state is going after researchers.
And by the way, while we talk about this, there's a number of security companies that have been breached, some with the SolarWinds attack and some not confirmed yet. But going after security companies seems to be a theme. I think a lot of people presume the SolarWinds version is a Russian-based attack, but not unusual. You know, if you think about it from a nation-state perspective, adversaries going after the security researchers in other countries are probably a good way to get in with a lot of potential victims. It makes perfect, darkly dystopian logical sense, but still logical sense.
And it makes sense. Like, you're going after the people that are hunting for basically zero-day vulnerabilities, where they want to go and report them and maybe collect a bug bounty, but at least like help out the community. And it makes sense why a nation state would go after them to try and head off those 0 days and potentially use them before they get patched.
What's kind of a bummer, but I think it all of us could on our lazy days fall for it. The fact that they open a Visual Basic project from any stranger and they don't kind of audit it themselves. I mean, anyone that has downloaded leaked source code on the underground, there's often botnet leaks out there. Often the leaks themselves are booby-trapped with Trojans. Some of the leaked bots try to siphon off your bots once you set up a botnet using that leak source. So it is kind of disappointing that folks didn't do a little more diligence around. I can't blame them for just going to a link that has 0 day that we don't know about. But taking a Visual Basic project and not actually looking a bit at the code before you compile and run it is probably not something you should do with any stranger on the internet, no matter how nice they are on Twitter.
Yeah, like at least with just straight source code, like a C source file, like it doesn't, like you can compile it, but it's not going to actually do anything unless you run it. But with the case of a visual project file, like a full Visual Studio project file, like there's a whole bunch of other stuff in there, like these build scripts and build events that can do other actions, like load up this library. So like you said, definitely be way more careful with what you get from strangers on the internet. But at the same time, like I can, like, no one is perfect, and I can see how they would fall for this. Like, and it makes sense they would target them, and it proves that no one is immune from cyber attack. Even these real security experts that are doing frontline analysis to try and find flaws.
No, I think that's a good. We are not perfect. We talk about security all day, but like the real patience and pure almost self-hate it takes to follow perfect best practices all the time. You know, other than CIA agents embedded in other countries fighting for their life, few people can really keep up the real OPSEC you need 24/7. So I definitely agree it could be a mistake anyone can make.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, it seems like these researchers, or not researchers, these foreign entities and just malicious hackers are really targeting the security community as a whole. Like, there's been several security vendors in just the past month that have been hit by 0 days and reportedly ransomware, or at least source code theft, I think was the latest one from Storm Shield, is it? Out of France?
Yep.
Seems like everyone is getting hit, and it doesn't matter how big or small you are, the attackers are going after these security companies. And honestly, as an employee of a security company, it's a little like, who's next kind of thing. But at least we can all use these recent attacks and these attacks against security researchers as a kind of kickstart to better our own security too. And any company can do that. You don't have to be a security company to learn from some of the issues that have impacted some of these recent breach victims. Like whether that be auditing your cloud infrastructure to make sure you don't have old tools hanging out in there, auditing your user accounts, making sure you've got strong password policies and multi-factor enabled wherever you can, making sure your multi-factor was deployed securely, because we've seen a few breaches caused by insecure MFA deployments now. Like there's a lot that every organization can learn from this rash of breaches that have happened in the last month or so.
Absolutely. By the way, totally random, but you know, when we were looking at this story, I have noticed lately a number of new Twitter followers that just seem random. I have been self-admittedly almost dead on Twitter for a month, trying to not pay as much attention. But I've gotten folks like Carla Bonfim and others, just random folks following me, even though I haven't done anything. So definitely stories like this get my paranoia meter up a little bit. No direct
messages. And
Carla,
if you're a real person and you're listening, thank you for listening to the podcast. And why have you not followed me too to get my account up?
Yeah. And who knows, Carla may actually be one of the new folks from WatchGuard too. So,
yep. But either way, like just be on the lookout. Seems like everybody's getting hacked these days. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_, Corey's at @SecAdept, and the both of us are at #the443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.